The process of getting bills through the state legislature by nature involves some pushing and tugging and arm twisting. This year in the Oregon legislature, some threats as well. Threats of retribution if the Democratic majority went ahead and passed a clean fuels bill, which it did, and the governor signed. So what is the problem with low-carbon fuels? That's a question we'll take some time exploring in this hour, because in Oregon's case, it's more than just the clean fuels bill. It's transportation funding and the departure of the former governor and his first lady who advocated for the clean fuels bill. These are all tied up in there. To help us pull things apart and get a better idea of what this is all about, we turn to Jana Gastelum, who's the Program Director of Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council. Jana, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to take a wild guess that Oregon has more environmental groups per capita than any state. We'll see if we can prove that later. But can you first tell us what the Oregon Environmental Council is all about?
Sure. Well, we've been around since 1968. We're a statewide environmental nonprofit, and we safeguard the things that Oregonians love: clean air, clean water, healthy food and farm systems. And then we look for smart business and market-based solutions that can help us move us toward a healthier environment and a healthier economy.
So by market-based solutions and smart businesses, it sounds like you're trying to make this a bit more palatable to people who could potentially either continue to make money they've been making or make new money because they're doing things more friendly to the planet.
Yeah, we think that a lot of consumers want to reward sustainable, friendly businesses, and that there really are market opportunities and niches for more sustainably produced goods as well. A great example of that actually comes from South Coast, Oregon, where a couple of years ago we worked with cranberry growers on some clean water business practices. They were able to then find market their own cranberries, since Oregon is actually a great state for growing cranberries. They're bigger, they're plumper, they taste better. But previous to this effort, they'd mostly just been sold into the basic commodity market. And with a little bit of special practices and special marketing, they were able to get a better price for their products and, I think, better overall long-term sustainability in their businesses.
So it sounds like a real businessy kind of thing there. We're talking about business practices and who they sell to, but it started with a clean water effort, you say?
It did, yeah. Back in, it was a couple of years ago. It predates my involvement with the Oregon Environmental Council, but I know that it's a very successful effort, and it was called the Clearwater Cranberry Initiative.
Mm-hmm. All right. Give us a little history lesson on the Clean Fuels Bill. It is not new, but it came up for renewal in this legislative session. Is that right?
That's correct. So the original Clean Fuels Bill was passed back in 2009, signed by Governor Kulongoski, and it gave our State Department of Environmental Quality the authority to move forward with a program that would reduce carbon pollution from our transportation fuels 10% over a 10-year time frame. And that's important because our transportation sector is the leading source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state.
All right, so 10%, you said, over 10 years then?
That's right.
So, it can be achieved. Is there no particular set of ratcheting guidelines, like it has to have 1% the first year, 2% the second year, anything like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the program was designed to be phased in over time. It ramps up over time so that you get, the early years, you have time for businesses to start investing and building out the infrastructure. Fleets can start converting over to lower carbon fuel use. It's a performance-based standard, which means that we have a goal, an outcome that we want, which is less carbon pollution, but it really lets the transportation sector figure out the best way to get there. It doesn't require any one particular type of fuel be used. It just requires that overall our fuels get cleaner. So that means, if you have a heavy-duty transportation sector, you're going to find the right solution that works there. Passenger cars have different solutions. And overall, the program doesn't regulate individual drivers or fleets. It's really about our fuel importers, which are, more of the oil companies that bring fuel into the state, since we don't refine or produce any petroleum here in Oregon.
So, Jana, just to be absolutely clear, though the program was voted in the 2009 legislature and signed by Governor Kulongoski, are there any requirements in place or have there been up to this point? Or was it sort of like this is our test drive and then with the renewal process, then we actually put the controls into place?
There has been a lot of process along the way. So the bill was passed in 2009. In 2010, there was a year-long advisory committee process with fuel importers, fuel users, clean fuel providers, and some public interest groups that helped to really provide input for how the program should be implemented and designed. That led to, in 2012, phase one of the program being adopted, which requires that our fuel importers report their fuel volumes and the carbon intensity of their fuels. They already report fuel volumes, so the only really new requirement was figuring out, you know, the carbon impact of their fuels.
And how is that measured?
That's measured. That's actually a really important point and a good piece of this program. It's measured by looking at all of the inputs it takes to extract, refine, process, distribute, and then the end use as well. So all the carbon emissions associated with, you know, what it might take to extract tar sands or the fertilizer that goes into growing a crop, or in some cases, how many emissions would be produced by a waste product if it wasn't put to better use, like being turned into a clean fuel. So all fuels are judged on the same complete carbon impact assessment, and then they're ranked accordingly. So the program really looks at pushing us towards those better, lower carbon fuels and away from the higher carbon fuels.
So I'm looking at the scale that provides the DEQ provides on its website. It's a good thing for folks to take a look at. And they range from a carbon score of 4 for biodiesel and inedible corn oil to a score of 89 for gasoline and E10. So this is just a straightforward thing. The gasoline E10 is the highest carbon impact?
That's right. So the highest carbon impact right now are gasoline and diesel fuels. But we also know that as petroleum becomes harder to extract and more what they call unconventional, that gasoline and diesel actually becomes dirtier and more expensive over time. So this program is encouraging us to move away from complete dependence on gasoline and diesel and moving towards cleaner fuels that can also be domestically sourced.
Okay, more to talk about with Janet Gastelum at Oregon Environmental Council about the Oregon Clean Fuels Program. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email when we come back in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Oregon Clean Fuels Program, recently renewed from a sunset by the Oregon Legislature and signed by Oregon Governor Kate Brown, to the consternation of Republicans and a lot of people in the business community. As you might have heard in the newscast at the top of the show, there's actually a lawsuit filed against the program already. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Janet Gastelum, who is the Program Director of Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council, which supports the program. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let me take a couple steps back and get a broader view again, Jana, for the folks who might just be joining us. The Clean Fuels Program in Oregon is it sounds similar to the programs in neighboring states. Is that right? It's sort of a, like, let's all do this together program?
That's right, Jeff. So California has a program that's been operational for many years. British Columbia also has a low-carbon fuel standard. And Washington State is contemplating moving forward. They have sort of a discussion draft set of rules. And as we know, the Oregon legislature authorized this program back in 2009, and it's been being worked on since then. But it really is time for full implementation of this program.
Was it as controversial in 2009's legislative session as it is in this year's legislative session?
Well, you know, there is an entrenched interest who, you know, has had a monopoly on our fuel marketplace. So that's gasoline and diesel. And this program is asking the fuels either to get better or for us to have more competition in the marketplace. I think it is very telling that back in 2009, the Western States Petroleum Association was ranked number 27th as a lobbying force in the state. And in 2013, the first session to lift the sunset on this program, they were actually the number one lobbying force. And that's despite the fact that Oregon doesn't produce or refine any petroleum here. So I think, you know, we're sometimes seen as a small state where larger outside special interests can try and dictate what we do. But I think Oregonians have really stood up and said, we care about our state, we care about its health, we care about our economy, and this is a good program on all of those fronts.
It's an interesting point you bring up, and a key one, I would think, that you mentioned twice, that there is no petroleum refined in the state of Oregon. So it seems like if, for example, motor fuels come from neighboring states, i.e. California, which already has similar standards in place, they're already making these fuels, aren't they?
So California does have a program in place, and they are making headway towards reducing the carbon impact. Oregon does import fuel from both California and Washington. But what we miss out on if we don't have a program is a buildup of that infrastructure to actually have these clean fuels made here in Oregon. And what we haven't touched on are all the different types of cleaner fuels that are actually available. So these are things like electricity, which will get increasingly cleaner over time as we integrate more renewables into the grid. Biogas is actually a really exciting new opportunity. And biogas is basically the methane that comes off of landfills and wastewater treatment plants and dairy digesters, and is a really potent greenhouse gas if it's just released into the atmosphere. But it can actually be harnessed and cleaned up and turned into basically a renewable natural gas. And companies like Waste Management are actually completing the life cycle. So they help, you know, collect the garbage. It may go to a landfill. And then they harness that that renewable natural gas off of landfills and run their trucks on it. So it's a really efficient and effective use of our waste stream for more productive uses.
So when you talk about – go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask if you're talking about infrastructure then to produce cleaner fuels in Oregon, I mean, talking about anything up to the level of refineries, or are we stopping a bit short of that because less is required to add stuff to existing fuels?
I think we're talking about the whole gamut of opportunities. So we do have some in-state production already happening. Sequential Biodiesel is a biodiesel company that uses waste grease. But they have the opportunity potentially to expand with a program like this in place. And I think we'll certainly want to keep an eye on our in-state producers and see what opportunities open up because of this program. But going back to biogas, so there was a report that was put out a couple of years ago showing that less than 10% of our biogas potential has actually been developed in the state. And in California, they've seen a four-fold increase in the use of biogas because of this program. So there's a lot of opportunity in a lot of rural areas and other places that have landfills and wastewater treatment plants to actually turn this to more productive purposes.
I noticed that we were talking about the carbon score, the carbon intensity score that the Oregon DEQ, which would have to administer the Clean Fuels Program, gives to various forms of fuel. Biodiesel and edible corn oil gets a carbon score of 4, very, very low. At the opposite end, gasoline and E10 up at 89. Biogas is very low as well at just a carbon score of 13. I wonder if there's some energy expended in the process, but if it scores some points for the capture of methane, thereby keeping a greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere.
That is exactly right. So again, when we're thinking about the full, what's called sort of the life cycle assessment of fuel. So what goes into making the fuel, any displacement or capture of greenhouse gas emissions that otherwise would have just been released, all of that gets factored in. And that's why you see fuels ranked in different ways. So really the waste stream fuels are the lowest carbon, and those are rewarded the most in this program or encouraged the most in this program. And then, you know, the middle tier and the higher carbon fuels are really more kind of transition fuels as we get more built out of those low carbon fuels.
I'm surprised at the jump here. Let me just read the whole list. We have a biodiesel and an edible corn oil with a carbon score of 4, biogas dairy digester 13, biodiesel waste grease 14, biodiesel canola 20, ethanol cellulosic 21, biodiesel soybean also 21, ethanol sugarcane 27. The carbon score for electricity is 27 as well, and then no middle, essentially. You go straight to CNG, compressed natural gas at 68, ethanol corn at 69, LNG, liquefied natural gas at 72, propane at 83, diesel and B5 at 87, and gasoline E10 with the highest carbon score at 89. So just back to process, I mean, how detailed a process did DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission, I'll presume, have to go through just to arrive at these carbon scores?
Well, there's a lot of good science that's out there, actually, on carbon scoring. And again, because other states and jurisdictions have programs in place, Oregon didn't have to start from scratch in thinking about these numbers. There's a lot of pretty well-established science out there on different processes, and it's gotten better over time because of programs like California's Low Carbon Fuel Standard. So it's all fairly well-documented, very well-researched, and I think what we're seeing because of the California program is that there's even some unexpected changes and improvements in some of the conventional fuels, like corn-based ethanol. We've seen that those fuels have actually gotten less carbon-intensive over time because of this program. So I think we'll see new fuel pathways developed, and I think we'll see improvements in existing fuels as well. So I think that table will continue to get filled in over time.
Janny, you mentioned at the outset the Oregon Environmental Council tends to look for market-based solutions to encourage people to do the right thing, essentially, for the planet. Is there much encouragement within what you do at the Oregon Environmental Council to look for new fuels? I mean, are there many programs you're involved with there?
We absolutely support innovation and new opportunities. Our own Oregon research universities are looking at how to convert algae into renewable fuels. So, yes, absolutely. We support innovation and continued thoughtfulness as we think about how we're going to power our transportation sector and our energy sector. We tend to focus a bit more on policies and programs that can help encourage that type of innovation. So things like the Clean Fuels Program, which, again, is performance-based and really rewards continuous innovation, certainly helps to create that business environment for bringing forward new fuels.
Janny Gastelum, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's the Program Director Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council based in the Portland area. We are talking about the Oregon Clean Fuels Program, just renewed by the legislature before it was allowed to sunset. First passed in the 2009 legislature and signed by then-Governor Kulin Goski. Renewed with this legislative vote, which had only Democratic yes votes in the House, and signed by Governor Brown a few weeks ago. Join us on the Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Boyd in Wolf Creek has used that email address. He wants to know, Jana, are the electric charging stations being used? How much? Increasingly, how are they priced for the user? A bunch of questions there. He says there's one in Wolf Creek that I've never seen used.
So I won't be able to comment on every single charging station in Oregon, but electric vehicles are certainly a part of the program and are supported under clean fuels. And Oregon actually has one of the best per capita networks in the country as far as our charging infrastructure. So if you want to be an EV driver anywhere in the country, Oregon is a great place to be an electric vehicle driver. We're also expanding electric vehicle tourism opportunities. The Fruit Loop around Hood River has some charging infrastructure. But, you know, each station is going to, you know, have its own sort of set of users. In some cases, you know, businesses want to show that they're being good stewards. And so they might not immediately have an electric vehicle fleet, but they certainly want to encourage either their own employees or other consumers to be able to use their facilities. So I think we'll see charging stations continue to develop and pop up. Some will be heavily used and some will take a little bit more time.
I'm going to guess orchard operations in the Hood River area have something to do with the name of that Fruit Loop you described?
The Fruit Loop, that's right. There's the orchards and there's the wineries.
So we are just talking motor fuels, right? I have not nailed it down to that point. We're not talking about like home heating or anything. That just motor fuels with the Clean Fuels Program?
That's correct. This is just for motor fuels. So gasoline and diesel. But there are a number of exempted fuel uses as well. Watercraft, agricultural equipment, military vehicles, railroads, and aviation. All of those are exempted under this program.
Well, you know, knowing what the consumption of diesel locomotives and jet planes can be, that's some pretty large sets of exemptions.
That may be, but that's also because a lot of these vehicles can be fueled outside of Oregon as well. And Oregon really can only look at fuel use within our state. So we get a little, you know, if we get beyond our boundaries, we just have to be mindful of that. So that's why aviation and railroads are exempted. The aviation sector, however, interestingly enough, has written in support of this program. They're being very aggressive on developing cleaner, renewable fuels for use in the aviation sector. And at some point, they may decide that they actually want to opt into this program.
We have an email here from Scott in Ashland. He writes, I'm generally in favor of the clean fuels program, but I am concerned about the possibility that it may encourage the use of E15, 85% gasoline, 15% ethanol, using corn-based ethanol, which I fear is bad agricultural policy, bad food policy, bad environmental policy, bad energy policy, bad for our cars, and highly questionable from the standpoint of reducing greenhouse emissions. Is it likely that we will see increased use of corn-based ethanol, and if so, will that have overall beneficial or detrimental effects? That again from Scott in Ashland.
Well, Scott raises some really great questions and ones that I think are common misperceptions about the program. So first of all, this program doesn't mandate the use of any particular type of fuel, and our ethanol blend rate is already set in law. It's a 10% blend rate, and this program doesn't supersede that in any way. When it comes to corn-based ethanol, again, this program encourages the use of better, lower-carbon fuels. And as you noted, Jeff, earlier in the program when you read out those different scores, that corn-based ethanol is actually sort of a mid- or higher-tier-ranked fuel. So what it really does is encourage us to use those waste stream fuels or those advanced biofuels that might come from cellulosic materials like food processing waste or the stems and leaves of trees, or the corn cobs and wheat straw stalks, the residue that's left over from agriculture. So that's what's going to be mostly encouraged under this program.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Brad in Ashland on the line. If the button will push, there we go. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jana Gastelum from the Oregon Environmental Council. We're talking clean fuels in Oregon.
Thank you very much for this program. And I do appreciate the Oregon Environmental Council. I get their mailings. And I appreciate my state for passing such a law as this to help clean us up. Every day that the sun is shining or that the wind is blowing, that we're not taking advantage of that, we're wasting money and we're polluting our own area. We're not utilizing a resource that's clean and that's free, that's reliable, that comes all the time. So I'm encouraging us to move in that direction. And I would do it by asking this question. She said there's a dollar amount on how much we spend from the state every day to import fossil fuels. And I guess there's a similar dollar amount for, let's say, Ashland, how much we spend out of our pockets every day that leaves our state to pay for these fuels. Well, what if you could take about a quarter of that amount, whatever they are, and eliminate it by recirculating that money in the economy, because the fuel is being supplied by sunlight and wind. And most gasoline is spent near people's houses. We don't need to have 300-mile range electric cars to have a car that goes up to the store and back again and again like we waste all our gasoline on. So anyway, I'm suggesting that by a transition to electric vehicles integrated to wind and solar, we would have almost totally clean fuel that would keep the money circulating here at home that we're now losing from the state and from our community to pay for these fossil fuels. So I'm guessing that distributed solar on rooftops and then wind farms in out-of-the-way places would go a long way to supplying us with the fuels we need and the transportation that we need, and would do so cleanly. So I really encourage this process, the OEC and the Clean Fuels Program.
All right. Thanks for that, Brad. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Jana?
Well, those are great points, Brad, and absolutely spot on. So the question was raised, how much do we actually spend on importing gasoline and diesel into the state? Well, of course, it depends on what the current fuel price is, but it's between $5 and $8 billion a year. That's a significant amount of dollars that goes right out of the state and into the pockets of oil executives. And so analysis was done back in 2010 to look at some of the economic impacts of keeping more of those transportation dollars in our state. There was also a study done by Drive Oregon on the benefits of electric vehicles specifically. And because more of our electricity is produced in state, and especially if we move towards cleaner sources like distributed solar or some of the wind farms, so that's direct economic development in Oregon. And that has a significant economic and environmental impact. So we are able to recirculate more of those dollars in our economy, put people to work with good family-paying wage jobs, and clean the air at the same time. It's a win-win.
We are going to be talking more with Janet Gastelum after a short break about the Clean Fuels Program in Oregon, passed by the legislature this year, renewing a program that was first begun 6 years ago. It has been signed by the governor over many loud objections, and we haven't even gotten to the whole part about where it's been tied up in the departure of Governor Kitzhaber. And First Lady is Sylvia Hayes. We'll get into that and talk more about the nuts and bolts of how Oregon's Clean Fuels Program is supposed to work when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Janet Gastelum and your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Oregon Clean Fuels Program, renewed by the state legislature and signed by the governor just a couple of weeks ago after a fairly loud battle in the legislature, which split right along party lines. Janet Gastelum's our guest on the exchange. She's Program Director Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council, which favors the clean fuel standards. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what is in the standards and what happens from this point forward. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. This all begins to settle in a bit as we go further along here, Jen, and I think the essence of what I've heard so far and the essence of the program is not that we're talking about changing any existing fuels, just using more of the ones that are less carbon intensive.
That's right, and really diversifying our fuel supply. So it gives people more opportunity to really have more choice. So, it's not just about gasoline and diesel anymore. It's about having a wider range of options available to consumers and businesses.
So one of the major complaints I think I heard is the general sense of we're not ready, that the fuel suppliers are not ready to deliver what the Clean Fuels Bill demands. And so what is the story, as you understand it, about the availability of the lower carbon intensity fuels?
The availability of low carbon fuels has been fairly well established through numerous assessments. The most recent one was a regional look at British Columbia all the way down to California and actually out to 2030. It was a study done by a group called ICCT. And what they found is that we can actually not only meet, but exceed the current standards that we have in place. I think conversations about delay and not being ready are exactly the same talking points that we hear over and over and over again from industry. And so, sometimes that can be valid, and so we take that into consideration in how a program is designed. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, that the curve for reducing the carbon pollution from fuels is slower at the beginning, and it picks up steam towards the end of the program so that you do have time to put infrastructure in place. But a lot of these fuels are commercially available. We're ready to make this transition, and we need to do it. We're overdue in making sure that this program gets fully implemented.
What kinds of incentives have been provided through the program in the first 6 years and from this point forward to encourage the creation of the lower carbon intensity fuels?
Well, unfortunately, because there has been pushback on the program itself hasn't been able to create incentives because there hasn't been certainty around it. the more we argue about the time frame and the fuel availability and supply, the more we send a signal to clean fuel producers that, you know, Oregon really isn't a good place to invest. And we certainly talked to a number of fuel innovators along the way who say, I would love to get more involved in Oregon, but I don't really know what's happening there. I don't have a sense that I'm really welcome, and I don't have a sense of policy stability. So really, the lifting of the sunset in this legislative session was a huge vote of confidence that Oregon is open for business and that we would like more investment in the state. Now, this program, this is another common misperception, it creates a demand and a market for cleaner fuels, but it doesn't take any state dollars, it doesn't provide any subsidies. So it simply says, we need to reach this performance goal, there's a market for it, and we're going to let businesses figure out how to get us there.
So it really is a market-based solution.
It is.
Yeah, all right, so no particular incentives, no carrots, but are there sticks as well? I mean, are there ways that what happens if the 10% reduction in carbon intensity isn't met in 10 years?
Well, if fuel providers, the fuel importers, who are the regulated parties in this program, have options to reduce their carbon impact, but don't, I think standard penalties apply just like in any other program. And so, you know, that's something to take very seriously. And I think we as citizens and people who care about the health and well-being also need to think about, you know, how we hold high polluters accountable for carbon pollution, because it's not free to keep polluting. You mentioned in the weather report that, you know, snowpack is low and we're not necessarily going to make up for that this spring. Those are huge impacts on our state, on our water supplies, on our shellfish industry that's already suffering from ocean acidification. We have, you know, the dryland part of the state where wheat is grown, and wheat is incredibly temperature sensitive. So there's a cost to inaction and there's a cost to delay, and we do need to think very carefully about how we hold people accountable for those costs.
We're talking about Oregon's Clean Fuels Program with Jana Gastelum, Program Director Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council. Join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for letting me on. This is a little off the subject, but dealing with cars and solar. I heard that there's a company exists, and I just wonder if it is feasible, if it does exist, to have it work in Oregon and maybe set it up with the Energy Trust or whoever you would deal with, that they actually, this company, when you have a solar car with batteries or a battery car, while sitting at home in your garage, the company installs some kind of electronic device that actually takes power from the infrastructure, the wiring system, you know, network all over the countryside, and puts it into your car during off-peak hours when the sun's down. So energy that would normally be lost because they can't store it from solar panels, they actually put it into your car battery. And then when you get up in the morning, there's enough power in your car so you can go to your job, and this instrument in your garage actually figures how much you normally use so you would never run out of power. But then they store and sell it back to the infrastructure. And it's supposedly you make like $50 to $100 a month on this. And I wonder if you ever heard of that and if it would possibly be feasible to help our energy problem in Oregon.
Okay, not necessarily a motor fuel thing, but certainly about energy. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it. Jana, anything that sounds familiar there?
Yeah, actually, this concept has been talked about for a number of years. It's called vehicle-to-grid technology. And there are a number of people who are really interested in using electric vehicles as part of our electric grid to help store energy, just as the caller said, and return that power when it's not needed in the vehicle. And it's sort of this smart grid type infrastructure that allows two-way communication between a car and the grid and can really help stabilize the system overall. And there could be benefits for drivers as well for helping to provide that energy storage service. So I think there are prototypes that are out there, and that's exactly the type of innovation that we would hope to see arise in Oregon over time.
So the car is the device that then makes your house more efficient regulates its use of electricity back to and from the grid.
Yeah, and it really is about that whole grid system. So there are times where perhaps at night a lot of wind power blows and there's not as much energy demand, but that's really good, clean energy, and we just need a way to store it. So as we have more and more electric vehicles plugged into the grid, those could act as those storage devices. And then after you drive to work and plug in, and it sits there during the day when there's higher demand for energy, you could feed some of that stored energy back into the grid exactly when it's needed.
Interesting. So very distributed sort of a power setup. Instead of having centralized storage batteries or pumping water up into reservoirs, so it'll fall down again at night for power generation. Interesting.
Yeah. It's sort of a way to democratize energy in a new way.
All right, let's take another call. Here's John in Mendocino, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Oregon Clean Fuels Program with Jana Gastelum.
Hi. I just wanted to remind people that the grid is the biggest consumer of energy. Even if nothing was connected to it, it still wastes more energy than you could ever, any other source could, or any other user could use.
Just through inefficiency, do you mean?
The demise of this animal, the psychological animal that we treat as if it were an umbilical cord, all this solar that's going into the grid is foolish. We need to get distributed power as soon as possible and stop with this mantra of the grid.
All right. Are you off the grid yourself, John?
Yeah. It was forced on me, but I wanted to do it. I just wasn't ready, and I've got an electronics degree, so I've studied electricity my whole life, and the grid is just infuriating me, you know, because it is the biggest waster in itself, because psychologically alone it would be the biggest waster, because it gives us all the idea that it's infinite power, even when solar connected to it. There's somehow this idea that if we all connect together, we'll just be better as a whole. It's not that way. Thermodynamics just is not smiling on this venture. And in the future, we'll look back and we'll say, what a foolish waste we did all those years.
All right. Thank you for that, John. Appreciate it. Jana, any thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that encouraging more efficient use of our energy is exactly what things like the Clean Fuels Program does. But we need to be smarter about all of our energy use, absolutely. If we care about the climate, if we care about our economy, we need to be much, much smarter in how we use energy, how it's produced, and to not waste it. I think we will see more and more distributed generation, and there's certainly some bills this legislative session making their way through on a variety of different types of solar, so residential solar, community solar, and utility-grade solar as well. So I think we'll see more of that come down the line as well.
One of the major arguments against the Clean Fuels Bill, just on a technical level, was that it would raise the price of fuel per gallon. And there is a range, I've noticed, but where do you fall within your own estimates of the Oregon Environmental Council within that range?
Well, we think it's important to look at some existing data that's on the ground. So again, California has had a program in place for 4 years. And what they have found is that, on average, it's cost less than one-third of a penny per gallon for compliance costs. So there are some industry-funded studies that are out there. The most well-known one, the Boston Consulting Group, was actually discredited by a group of independent university experts from Stanford and MIT and UC Davis and the National Lab System. So I really think the numbers at the highest end of the range have to be taken with a grain of salt. Again, this is exactly what industry always does. They overestimate costs, and they underestimate compliance and innovation. So we think that the fuels that are available, electricity, many biofuels are actually already lower cost than gasoline and diesel. With continued innovation, we think we'll see more of those on the market. We really expect that with more choice and competition in the marketplace, that consumers will win overall.
The you know, it's hard to get a handle on the many ways that the Clean Fuels Bill got shots fired at it on its way to passage in this session of the Oregon legislature. But one of them, of course, was the fact that one of its advocates was former First Lady Sylvia Hayes, and her advocacy mixed with her accepting money from advocacy groups ended up being the undoing of Governor Kitzhaber. He ended up resigning. Did the legislature, from your perspective, watching the process, ever seriously consider holding off on this, as was suggested by the likes of the Oregonian Editorial Board and a bunch of Republicans?
You know, I was really impressed and heartened by the commitment that the legislature showed to this program. So everyone knows the history of this program. Again, it was passed back in 2009 and signed by Governor Kulongoski. And the benefits of the program really, again, are not only in diversifying our fuel supply, but also in cleaning up our air. Transportation fuels are a major source of criteria air pollutants. And anyone who lives near roadways knows how harmful that can be to kids and pregnant women, the elderly. So a lot of legislators were really dedicated to this program from a health perspective. There were a number of voices who also feel like, you know, there's an opportunity to develop cleaner fuels in Oregon and in our region, and that's a great economic development opportunity as well. So I think there was a lot of commitment to this program, and it certainly showed. I mean, there were hours of floor debate, and there were some really moving statements made by those who were supporters of the program.
Well, not having had the outcome they wanted in the legislature, the opponents of the Clean Fuels Bill have now moved to the courts. How seriously do you take the threat from lawsuit at this point?
Well, you know, it's too bad that the oil industry would rather litigate than innovate. This is another expected tactic. We saw this happen in California, and we really saw, you know, these are basically a recycling of the same claims that failed in California. This program has been very well designed and carefully thought out. It's withstood legal challenges in California, and we think that this program will prevail here in Oregon as well.
Are there any visible things that consumers of motor fuels will notice? Will there be big, you know, Clean Fuels Program stickers on pumps or anything like that, or is this just something that's intended to run in the background?
I think it may vary. There are companies out there like Propel Fuels who are really marketing cleaner fuels. They're providing some renewable diesel and some other really innovative fuels, and they want their consumers to know it. They think that they'll have a market advantage. So in some cases, things won't look very different, but in other cases, there'll be new business opportunities, and we think that consumers will respond to that.
We will see. The target is a 10% reduction in carbon intensity of motor fuels in Oregon over the course of the next 10 years. Jana Gastelum is the Program Director Climate at the Oregon Environmental Council. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet.